We have scheduled an overview on the fiber optics right-of-way question, primarily based on a letter I received from the governor on May 1st that seemed to be implying that the legislature was involved in one side or another of a decision that I hadn't figured out. So I'd like to hear the background and exactly what is going on. Commissioner Shively, and thank you for...
Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is John Shively. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. What I'd like to do is give you a brief overview of this situation and let you ask questions. This is actually the third hearing that the legislature has held on this. There was one in the House Telecommunications Committee and another hearing chaired by Senator Taylor and Senate Judiciary. There are a variety of state agencies that can give rights of way, and fiber optics, because it is somewhat new technology and because there is a lot of money involved, has raised, I think, some interest on behalf of both the state administration and others about how we go about giving rights away to private companies. Traditionally, the state has sought to encourage infrastructure development, and a lot of law that's on the books or regulations that are on the books lead towards encouraging development. And I think that as we go through this, you'll see there's sort of a couple paths we can go down here. That is one of them. The other is maximizing revenue. And there are at least six state agencies that could provide rights of way to fiber optics companies. Two, the university and the Mental Health Lands Trust generally do not have large pieces of land and therefore aren't big players here. The Alaska Railroad, which has negotiated, I think, some very lucrative arrangements with a couple companies, is another. There are two parts of DNR, our general public lands, of course, and then there is an application for a right-of-way through Chugach State Park along the power line. Ordinarily, probably, we wouldn't lease in parks, but since we have a utility right-of-way that existed before the parks, we can do that. And then the final state agency is the Department of Transportation. Now, to sort of go where we are with all of those, the Department of Transportation is basically prevented by law from charging for rights-of-way. They can charge a one-time fee for the permit, which is essentially a processing fee, but they cannot charge an annual rental rate. Traditionally, the Department of Natural Resources has done one of two things with utility rights of way. One, which we're required to do for nonprofits by law, and the other, which we have sometimes done even for profit-making utility companies, is to charge a one-time 10 cents a linear foot fee, just about 1 year. But recently, we've been more accustomed to charging an annual rate based on a value of land or the right in land that we're giving away, and that, by regulation, equates right now to about $100 an acre. And here...
Okay, $100 an acre is 6 cents a foot. And
I'm going to try to make all. It gets somewhat confusing, and that equates here generally to about 6 cents a foot. Although that's for about a 20-foot wide right of way. If people wanted to ride a wider right of way, obviously it would be more. The railroad has negotiated rights of way that basically started around 47 and 48 cents. And then they have some ability to share revenues. We have never, at least on public lands, thought that that we really negotiate. We have the ability, as I said, to set this fee. Now, there's one other ability we also have by regulation that we have never used before, and that is to make a value of the use. And here, the value of the right in the land to put a cable, particularly since a big part of this, as you see from your map, is across the bottom of Prince William Sound, we think, you know, can equate to around $100 an acre. But we believe, or 6 cents a linear foot, but we believe if you valued that on the use to the customer, in this case the fiber optics people, because basically based on what we've seen at the railroad, that we could get that up to 50 cents a foot. However, if we were to...
Can I interrupt? Certainly. Back up. You say recently this change attitude. What do you mean by recently? What happened 3 years ago? What happened? I mean, what is recently?
Well, I think in the last year or so, as the railroad negotiated these more lucrative deals, it caused us to relook at what we were doing. I think that's what's really driven
us. So until, say, 2 years ago, it was just issue them sometimes based on an initial fee and sometimes without any continuous fee after that?
Yeah, I think more recently, the ones that I've seen in the last 2 or 3 years have all been on annual rate based on about $100 an acre.
Okay, so the last 3 years at least is what recently is.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
trying to get some kind of baseline. Maybe I'll ask another one. What's the difference in fiber optics and putting a 500 pair phone cable down? What's the difference to the state?
Well, there's no difference to the state. Where we think it may be, and why we think the value of the use is that the fiber optics, because so much can go across it, is a much more lucrative use of the land. And so you're basically trying to determine what that use could be.
So part of this is although it's not necessarily trying to take a percentage to be profit sensitive, but it is trying to be profit sensitive because that is a technology that is more profit intensive. Is that?
That's the... Well, and as I said, we've never used this before, and I think to be perfectly frank, it was driven by looking at what the railroad did. I mean, we were sort of running along pretty happy about $100 an acre and thinking that was a pretty decent rate, and the railroad comes along and negotiates a much higher rate, and we thought we ought to look at that. And the railroad actually, I'm not totally familiar. First of all, I'm not an appraiser, and secondly, I'm not totally familiar with what the railroad did. But we are not convinced that the 50 cents would necessarily survive an appraisal. If we had set the 50 cent a foot rate, whoever we gave it to, whether it was GCI or MFS or North Star, which are the three companies that are in front of us, they would have the right to come in and do an appraisal under our appraisal instructions, and so it could be lower. But what we ultimately chose to do, which I think followed somewhat, I think the first piece of correspondence between the legislature and the administration, was to do what we've traditionally done, which was to take the $100 an acre. And there was a letter that I received from the four finance co-chairs, I think in February, that indicated that that wasn't appropriate.
Okay, so the first legislative correspondence was four co-chairs, February of this year, said issue leases to whoever's applying for 6 cents a foot, $100 an acre. Is that right?
Yeah, they didn't use that term, but that was the way I read the letter, yes.
Okay. Is there any dispute about that it meant that, or?
I don't think so.
That's February.
What date in February?
You mentioned. Well, the governor had a...
Senator, would you mind if I got a cup of water?
No, go right ahead. It looks like it would
be good water.
223 in the next page of the governor's letter to us on May 1st is a schedule of communications. And that's what kind of got my interest up. Is
February 23rd.
February 23rd. Okay, go ahead. Continue.
I think, to bring us up to where we are today, after the correspondence that was spelled out and the two hearings that took place, we just wanted to make it clear to the legislature where we were. And I think In March, we initially spelled out that it was our intent to proceed using what we traditionally used, which was $100 an acre for public lands. And, you know, there was a sense of the House, there were letters back and forth, and the purpose of the last letter was saying, well, we still intended to do that. The one change we put in there in the last letter was that we would agree, as had been suggested, to putting together a group in the interim to look at setting a what's called a consistent state policy. There's been a lot of discussion of whether or not there ought to be a consistent state policy among all state landowners. That may be a challenge given the six different entities I talked about. But anyway, we agreed to put together the group that I think had been suggested in the sense of the House motion, and that we would issue the rights away at our existing rate and give the people that got those 5 years at that rate. And then if the legislature had changed the rate, then when we went back to reassess rates, which we traditionally actually do for rights away, then we would use whatever the legislature's policy was at the time.
Okay, keep going.
I think that brings us up to date. It's probably easier for me to answer questions.
So they write to you saying, urging prompt processing of pending right-of-way applications. You write to them 18 days later. Agreeing with the use of existing standards and historic price methods, and urging the legislature to hold public hearings, that you won't do anything until April 24th, which obviously is passed. Then in March, the House has hearings. There's another letter from the Speaker on April 6th. Urging equal treatment for all. Now, what's that say? How does that compare to the previous communication?
Well, I think the previous communication from us?
No, from the legislature.
Our position has been is that you can't treat everybody equally unless the legislature chooses to act, because you have different authorities and different organizations. DOT is prevented by law from charging anything other than their one-time processing fee. We have, by law and regulation, more flexibility. The railroad is yet a third entity that has their own particular
flexibility.
Yeah, well, and they did. I mean, they negotiated as a business, and I won't get into the... But, I mean, and I think within the keeping of the way, at least I perceive the railroad, what they did was appropriate for the railroad. So to treat everyone equally, I don't believe is possible, unless the legislature wants to set a state policy for all state lands, and it means amending the DOT statutes, our statutes, railroad statutes at the minimum, and then you can debate about whether or not you want to deal with the university and mental health. I think it's not as necessary because they don't have the large chunks of land that the other three do.
Well, my concern starts, you know, is with getting a letter expecting a major resource policy to get changed on May 1st with an adjournment date, you know, 12 days away. That's what my concern is, and yet I don't want to be tied to the communication of individual legislators as that being the policy of the legislature.
And we understand that. Of course, you know, it's our feeling that we gave our first communication in March and gave indication in March that if the legislature wanted to deal with this, here's what we intended to do. There was, as I said, it's not on here, but sometime within, I think, a week or two after that March 11th letter, a hearing in House Telecommunications, and then a couple of weeks ago or so, Senator Taylor had his hearing. So the May 1st letter was not the first letter.
Yeah, that was the first time it came to my attention.
And we
resource issue. Senator Ward, did you have a question?
I did. Have you given thought to some other options, if even necessary, to resolve this? Some other ways of going about it besides the sense of the House appointing a committee and a quick fast-tracking legislation? Have you given thought to any other ways that this might be resolved in the interest of the people?
Well, if people want, it depends on what you want, Senator. There are a variety of ways to solve this. We believe, that given when we wrote the May 1st letter, that the appropriate method is to bring the various state interests together in the interim and make a recommendation to the next legislature. I mean, I think there was a recognition in our May 1st letter that you didn't have time at this point. Although, you know, if somebody wanted to spend the time, we were willing to do that, but I think there was a recognition that basically the legislature had probably run out of time.
Do you feel that you have to issue leases under the existing policy?
Do I have to issue under the existing policy? As I think I stated, I have the option of, if the existing policy is the $100 an acre fee, I have the option of doing that, or the option of doing a use value, which we believe would be 50 cents a linear foot, and then subject myself to an appraisal. We have chosen what we were going to do, which is do what we've traditionally done. I have an option to do something else.
I mean,
DOT has no option to do anything else than what they've already done.
I mean, it stands to reason that a lease along a corridor with a railroad, you know, right straight along the tracks has got to be worth a heck of a lot more than a lease that goes up over Power Line Pass with virtually nothing underneath it.
Well, I'm not an appraiser. I think that the railroad has certain advantages, particularly, as I understand it, to the first people that got there. There was in their appraisal, I know, extra credit given for the fact that it was a corridor. And we, on land, which in your map is the right-of-way that MFS has, it goes from Valdez to Dead Horse, we don't really have a corridor. We own some of it under DOT, some of it under DNR, and then some of it's federal. The the subsea lands are all ours. Whether you'd give the subsea a corridor value or not, I don't know. We don't. The one time that we appraised for subsea, we got a pretty low appraisal, which was for an AT&T line, well below the 6 cents.
Senator Taylor?
John, you've mentioned a couple times historical. I've got an August 30th, 1996 Department of Natural Resources letter here to a Mr. Frank Colucci. So that's 2 years ago. And it says, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Lands, reserves the right to establish a method for determining fair market value for the right-of-way permit proposed to be issued to MFS for a fiber optic cable line generally located along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline routes.
Right.
So historically in 96, they were told it was fair market. Then when you... the department did a proposed finding in November, a couple months later, 3 months later. It says annual rental of the permitted land will be established by an appraisal accomplished by MFSNT according to appraisal instructions prepared by both BLM, so the federal government must be using that method, and Division of Lands. So you told them a second time in the proposed findings that you were going to use an appraisal method with the instructions on how to do the appraisal coming out of your department, Department of Lands. And then we end up with a permit that is issued. land use permit from Alaska Department of Natural Resource Division of Lands, MFS, May 9th, 97, about a year later, 9 months later, and in paragraph 20 it says, the division has not completed its final decision of right-of-way application, Alaska Division of Lands, and gives a number. This decision shall include the appraisal method and other factors, if any, to determine the fee for the permittee's long-term use of the subject property. The decision, which is an appealable document, shall be submitted to the permittee for review prior to issuance of an early entry authorization. It sounds to me from these documents out of your department that historically you were talking about a fair market appraisal process being done, and the permittee was aware of that and aware of it at least two different occasions. And then both you and I went through the memorandum that your own Department of Lands division head, Jane Anvik, wrote to you, where she, on February 25 of this year, 2 days after or 3 days after the letter had been received from the four people in the legislature, she strongly recommended the appraisal method, and it was an extensive draft document of, gosh, I don't know how many pages it is, but she put a lot of time in on that. So when did history change, I guess,
well,
is my question.
Several things. One, the history has not really been with fiber optics. We've, I think, only had one other major fiber optics project, which was AT&T Alascom. And as I said, the offshore appraisal came in well below 6 cents. We were concerned. We wanted to keep our options open. MFS wanted to get in. They were willing to go in without us setting a rate. Now, when you get to what is fair market value, I think that's a term that has been a little bit misused in the debate here, because there are a variety of ways to determine market value. And the example, as you know, I like to use is in the real estate business. When you have a building, you can look at it as depreciated value, its replacement cost, its income value, and you can come out with three very different values for a building. And the same is true here. If you value the right in the land, as we sort of have traditionally done, we believe you come up with the fair market value of about $100 an acre. Now remember, the $100 an acre is $100 a year, so that really equates to about $1,200 or so dollars an acre for the actual value in the land, because you're running it down at about an 8% rate. We do believe that if we valued it, if we looked at the value based on the use, the value of the use to the people that are using the cable, that we could increase that. The February memorandum that was drafted at my request by Ms. Anvik and her staff, because I wanted to look at it. We had not made a policy decision, and we were debating it. And this debate has gone on a fairly long time. And at the end of it all, we chose the approach that we chose. In early March, said this is the approach, these are the issues. And if the legislature thinks that there's a better way or different way to do this, we're willing to work with the legislature. And what we've now said is, okay, you know, that opportunity is probably past this particular point. But what we're suggesting is that we look at this in the interim and come back with recommendations or options for the next legislature. So, I mean, we're not necessarily done with this issue, but this is the way we intend to proceed.
Senator Traylor.
Well, John, it seems to me that Ms. Anvik writes up this extensive memorandum, and she strongly encourages you to adopt a policy of appraisal to find out what fair market value is. You've already told the applicant that you're going to come up with instructions on how the appraisal will be established. Now, that's February 25. The letter you write back to the legislature is through the governor is March 4. We're only talking about 5 days here. I mean, Ms. Anvik's letter is hot off the press. Where was this decision? Was this a decision you made on your own? Did you consult with the third floor on it? Who came up with by the foot, three different amounts, as opposed to appraisal, do fair market value, and set up a standard state policy. I mean, somebody made this decision at some point in time.
Well, it was a decision, as most major policy decisions, that were made basically by the commissioner in consultation with the governor's office. And obviously, I discussed it with the governor's office. It was the governor that communicated back to the legislature.
I think my concern, John, is that this decision, whether to go with 6 cents a foot, or like if you just took the ball thing, 6 cents for one, and then you took the railroad at 50 cents, and in fact, that's not a straight 50 cents. That's a percentage of their gross. That one can go to $1.50 a foot per year. So if we've got $1.50 at the top end as a market approach based on what their gross may be, and 6 cents at the bottom, and your own department people recommending, let's find out some fair market value here, that's quite a major decision to make when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of project and right-of-way. I think that's where the nut of this problem is. We're trying to figure out, how was this decision achieved? I mean,
well, it was achieved based on our decision that we would keep with what we thought was the traditional state encouragement of the development of infrastructure. I mean, there are laws like the DOT law that are certainly designed to encourage. Not only does DOT basically give the right-of-way for free, they have a processing fee. If they decide to move the road, they have to move the utility at DOT's cost. I mean, and we traditionally have tried to keep the lease rates reasonable as a way to encourage infrastructure. Do you have to do it in this case? That was something we debated. We don't know the answer to that. Our corridors are a little different than the railroad. The one, as I said, is an undersea route that we're looking at through Prince William Sound and in through here, and the other one is up along the highway, of which they're actually, it's not a corridor that we can totally control. So they're not familiar, and I know in the railroad appraisal that they gave a substantial credit, I think a 50% credit, for the fact that there was a straight corridor, one owner to deal with, one pricing scheme, one manager. We could not offer that.
Yeah, I appreciate those complexities. I think DOT in a discussion of it, though, is kind of an anomaly because you're not crossing that much of DOT's land. I mean, you might be crossing a highway here or there. The majority of the investment in this project for this purchaser is within the right-of-ways that they're going to acquire along various routes. I mean, if we were talking oil here, John, and we were trying to decide whether oil was worth $6 a barrel or $150 a barrel.
$150.
Yeah. And all the decisions that are being made on it are being made by one or two people sitting on the third floor chatting about this. You have to kind of wonder why the decision was made. And just to say that, well, we're going to benefit the development of fiber optic cable in the state, that may be quite a sacrifice or quite a subsidy being paid on the part of the people of Alaska if, in fact, market must have something to do with the ability to develop something, and I would imagine the railroad went through that too. They sat down and said, well, if we charge them too much, they can't develop and they won't be able to use our line. If we charge them too little, we'll be subsidizing them in the process, and yet I see a window here of about 3-4 days where the information and the history is all fair market appraisal, and then poof, a decision is made, and not only is a decision is made, but then a challenge is sent to the legislature. If you don't like our decision, do something about it. That's the way I read the letter that was received.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't want to be too contentious here, but the use fair market value is not an appropriate use here. There are several, more than one way to get to fair market value. And we have fair market value appraisals on land along the pipeline that are substantially below 6 cents. Mm-hmm. So a fair market, and that's what we've traditionally used, is the value of the land. That is a fair market value, the value of the land. The value of the use is another way to get the fair market value. That, as we have indicated, is a higher way to do it. We've never used it before, but we believe it would get you to a higher rate. We can't guarantee that because we've never seen an appraisal done on it, but anyway, we believe that. We made the decision, and I will take full responsibility for that decision.
Just one last question, John. When it came to Powerline Pass and Chugach State Park, were you charging for the use of the land, or were you charging for the land value? And because there you charged well above 50 cents a foot to the very same person. You charged them 50 cents a foot, then you required them to put in a
conduit
large enough that it could handle future people that might want to go up through that same area. So DNR land right alongside of the park gets 6 cents, but if it's in the park, it's 50 cents plus a conduit that's very expensive to put in. That, to me, I have a hard time rationalizing that. Maybe you can explain that one to us.
Chairman, Senator Taylor, I'd be happy to. First of all, although they were required to put in an extra conduit, they will get credit off of the 50 cents for putting that in. So we did require something extra, but then we were giving them credit for it. So that, and we have not finalized that agreement, but that's the concept.
What do we charge the next guy that goes through the same conduit?
We will charge them the rate to go through the park, which is 50 cents, I understand it. I do believe the park land is more valuable.
So there it's a use determination?
Actually, I believe that going through it, first of all, you'd almost never go through a park. We wouldn't even be talking about going through a park if the power line wasn't there. We've done it because there is an existing utility, but we think the parkland has extra value, and we valued it that way. I think parkland is more valuable than general use land. So it's been set aside.
Based on history, or?
Based on the fact that a previous legislature set aside that land for a specific purpose, and that purpose is for public enjoyment.
My confusion, John, I'll quit here, honestly, but my confusion is, where in the world did you get the number 50 cents?
We took it, I mean...
Is it appraised as that, or is it just we have this aura about parks and that they shouldn't be touched for less than 50 cents?
It was a negotiated rate, looked at it about what we thought the market was, but we did it because it is parkland. It was negotiated. It was a different situation. It's not a fee schedule the way that we have a fee schedule in our regulations for general public use lands. We don't have a fee schedule for utilities across park lands because we basically don't do it. And the park people weren't convinced they were going to do it at all. And it was something that was negotiated between GCI and the park people in order for them to get the right of way.
Park people?
That's our Division of Parks.
So they negotiated with your Division of Parks separately from you?
Yes.
But other people had to negotiate with you?
But with my concurrence. I mean, it was my decision to allow them to do that and to sign off on the approach.
So Parks got to charge 50 cents, but Jane Anvik got told, no, you can't charge market value. I'll make that decision.
Right.
You understand my concern, John, that each of these decisions make huge dollar differences if you're the applicant, and that maybe that needs some semblance of stability or review or policy other than just a 2 or 3 day window when somebody sits down on the third floor?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to respond to the 2 or 3 day window. This is an issue that we discussed for several months. It wasn't a 2 or 3 day window. And it was the decision we ultimately came to.
Okay, thank you.
Just with regard to your letter, or the governor's letter, it says that your intention is to go forward, if there's no other indication, is to go forward with the 6 cent rate, but with a 5-year limit, so they're reopened. why did you pick a 5-year rate? Does that matter if that's a 2-year rate, a 1-year rate, a 10-year rate? How does that work?
I don't know that matters. Traditionally, we've reappraised at the end of 5 years in our rights of way. I think that's why we chose it. I don't know that there's huge magic to it.
So if the legislature were actually going to do something next year and you had a committee that was going to work on it in the interim, you might choose to issue leases and have a 2-year reopener, for example.
That's within the, yeah, I think that's within the realm of possibility.
Okay, that's all I have. I'd kind of like to hear from the industry and see if I can sort out who's on whose side or isn't. I don't. Okay. We've got a sign-in sheet. If you'd stay around, we. Okay. We've got Ron Duncan from GCI. We have a number of people on teleconference, too. Thank you for joining us. I really hadn't asked these questions before.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Duncan. I'm the president of GCI. I've got about a 5 or 6 minute prepared summary that I'd like to go through, and then I'd be happy to address perhaps some of the same questions you directed to the commissioner. I think there are three principal things we need to look at, and one of those issues has three subsets. The first thing is three key issues with respect to right-of-way. Number one, with regard to fiber optics, the importance of fiber optic facilities. Number two, the fact that not all rights-of-way are the same. And number three, the fact that policy and tax stability are real important to industry investment. Then I think we need to stop and ask, does any of this really matter? And then the final question I'd like to put into play is what's really going on here, and to suggest that this is just another variant of phone wars. First of all, with respect to rights of way, the first thing that you need to recognize is that fiber optics is a tremendously important infrastructure for the state. Fiber optics provides the backbone of the modern communication systems. It's the technology that allows us to get very large capacities at relatively low unit costs to meet the increasing demands for bandwidth. The availability of fiber optics and the consequent low-cost, high-bandwidth capabilities are becoming critically important to the economic development of this state's infrastructure. And in fact, historically, state telecommunication policy has been highly concerned about the lack of fiber. In fact, merely 2 years ago, the Telecommunications Information Council, in their assessment of state telecom policy, suggested that perhaps the state was going to have to subsidize by as much as $50 million the installation of the next fiber optic cable into Alaska, because the participants in the marketplace didn't appear to be able to make the market economics work, and the state had a critical need for the fiber optic infrastructure. So in the space of 24 months, we've come from a state that had a telecommunications policy concern where perhaps it was going to have to subsidize fiber optics to a situation where the state is now saying, well, gosh, maybe we should be taxing the living daylights out of these things by going to some sort of a value of use phenomena. So quite a change from the telecom policy respect, regardless of what's happening on the lands use policy respect.
Do we have any operational fiber optics working now, Anchor, Fairbanks, or anywhere?
The line along the railroad is operational. I don't know whether it's carrying any paying traffic yet. The second point on rights of way is that not all rights of way are the same. Commissioner Shively described 7 different granting agencies within the state. Different rights of way also have different characteristics. Those characteristics create differing values in those rights of way to users. The key characteristics that users look at in evaluating rights of way are construction cost, security, maintainability, and market size. Construction cost is simply what's going to cost you to put your fiber optic facility in to that particular right of way. In that case, the premier right-of-way is probably railroad right-of-way because there's a device that mounts on the railroad tracks and hangs a plow off the slide and runs right up the tracks. Typically, along the tracks, you don't have many other cables crossing. You don't have to stop to avoid cutting 16 other utilities' cables or rupturing a dozen gas lines along the way. So the installation process on a railroad has relatively high efficiency and relatively low unit cost. In fact, for terrestrial rights of way, for terrestrial construction, railroad construction is the cheapest. Road construction is the second cheapest because you can have access to the site. Off-road construction, where you're going through either parklands, in the case of power line pass, it's not quite as bad because there is an existing road. In some cases, you have to go and plow across the swamp in the winter. That's your most expensive access because it's the most expensive to construct. Security of the right-of-way has to do with what the likelihood is that somebody's going to dig up, rupture, or break your cable. Again, the premier right-of-way here is probably the railroad. The only way your cable gets broken on the railroad is when the train derails and it manages to go down 4 feet in the derailment. That does occasionally happen, but that's a relatively low-frequency occurrence. Highway rights-of-way tend to be relatively vulnerable. You get a lot of people with their backhoes digging out the drainage ditch on their driveway, and they manage to go through your fiber optic cable. Remote rights-of-way are somewhat more secure, although access to them can be a very significant problem if you do have an outage, because some of the stuff that crosses wetlands you can't actually physically get to during the summer. You can only get winter access. Maintainability is really the issue of what's the response time to repair. Here, terrestrial right-of-ways have a tremendous advantage over undersea right-of-ways. A terrestrial right-of-way typically can be repaired in a good situation in under an hour to a difficult situation in under 2 or 3 hours. Undersea rights of way.
Fiber optics is, I mean, how do you repair a fiber optic cable?
You splice it. There's a little box.
It splices and the same way that a multi-pair cable splices?
Well, you don't use a soldering iron, no, but
actually,
there's a little box that cuts the cable and heats and splices the fiber optics back together, and you end up with one continuous cable just the way you started before the guy with his backhoe got at you. Undersea cable on maintainability is probably the worst, because undersea cable creates a situation where when you're out, you're typically out for 2 to 3 weeks at a time, and the maintenance cost of undersea cable is much higher because you have to have a ship on standby. And typically, for instance, in GCI's case, we'll pay multiple millions of dollars a year for a fiber ship on standby. We'll share that with one other cable, and 99% of the time that ship sits in port, but the crew's got to be on 6-hour call and you got to pay the whole cost of the ship. So you've got both a maintainability problem and a cost of repair problem on undersea cable that's substantially different from repairing a cable where you can base your splicing unit on a railroad car or in a truck that you can drive to the site. The final issue in determining the value to the user of right-of-way is the market size. How big is the pot of gold at each end of the fiber? What size market are you serving? Obviously, if your fiber cable is running from Washington to New York, the value to the user of access along that corridor is much greater than the value of access from Anchorage to Juneau, because the potential market is so much smaller. Rights of way also have somewhat varying value to owners based on their scarcity. And here you've got a situation where exclusivity creates a potential value to the owner of a right of way. If there is only one right-of-way available, and there are potentially multiple users for that same right-of-way, basic economics is going to tell you that that right-of-way has a lot more value than a situation where there are, say, an unlimited number of rights-of-way and a very limited number of users. Let's take the case of the railroad. The railroad essentially has one usable right-of-way. While the railroad contract is written as 25 feet, this from one side of the tracks, if you'll take a trip along the railroad, you'll discover that if you want to get all the way from Anchorage to Fairbanks, there's only one side of the tracks that's usable, because in many cases the other side of the tracks drops off into oblivion. And if you granted a single right-of-way to the first entrant to the choice 25 feet that's exclusive that nobody else can get into, and assuming there might be multiple people who want that right-of-way, that right-of-way has a scarcity or a monopoly value proportional to how many people want to get into that right-of-way for whatever reason. On the other extreme, let's take undersea right-of-way. There are essentially an unlimited number of undersea right-of-ways that are available through Prince William Sound and through Southeast Alaska. You could fit more fiber optic cables than there are fiber optic companies in this country in those areas. So on a pure demand basis, the value of those rights-of-way should be very close to zero if you're looking at the market-based pricing in terms of how many can we accommodate. You run into some very weird problems when you take the pricing that a single user, that the highest bidder essentially, is willing to pay for an exclusive right-of-way, and then you say, we want to charge that price for all other rights-of-way, for an exclusive right-of-way that has better characteristics, and then even though that's one you only have one of and you want to get the highest price for, you then say, well, that should set the market rate, and even though we could give an unlimited number of rights-of-way through Prince William Sound, we're going to artificially limit the number of potential fiber optic cables because we're going to charge that premium price that somebody was willing to pay for the much better right-of-way that only one of is available. So you have to be very careful in how you're valuing the fiber optic right-of-ways and with what you're saying the market value of that right-of-way is. This issue has been largely raised by WorldNet, who is attempting to persuade people that the 50 cents a foot, if they really paid 50 cents a foot along the railroad, sets a price that should be used de facto for all other rights-of-ways. And if you do that, you artificially raise the price of other goods, other rights-of-way, which are essentially an infinite supply, and by raising the price, you choke off consumption. You're going to reduce the amount of fiber optic right-of-way that's used. So in addressing the WorldNet issue, you have to address, first of all, what they're paying, and second of all, what is parity? Because it doesn't seem that parity is simply paying the same thing they're paying if they have exclusive use of the premier form of right-of-way. With respect to what they're paying, that's not clear either, because they went in on a non-competitive procurement with the railroad and negotiated a deal. They negotiated a deal that met their terms and conditions, a deal that, in fact, in the first year has a rental of zero, and the minimum rental payments increase over a 10-year period, presumably as their business grows, but it's a deal that met their specific business conditions that they went in and negotiated one-on-one with the railroad without any public policy input from anyone or without any knowledge of competitors that this was going on, and they paid whatever they thought it was worth. It's logical to think that perhaps they paid a premium to keep other people out of that same right-of-way. But they emerged with a deal, and the first anybody else saw this deal was after it had been executed by the railroad. Now we're saying that that deal, which applies to their specific right-of-way, presumably the premier right-of-way in the state, which is why they're willing to go in and try and negotiate for it, should then set the benchmark that's paid for all other rights-of-way, including 300 miles of ground on the bottom of Prince William Sound. And that not only that deal, but those terms and conditions that were designed to suit that company's interest, zero rental the first year because they're a startup company and they don't have revenues. Well, our company might be very happy to pay a rental starting the first year because we have other revenues. But the suggestion here is that the terms and conditions negotiated in private by one company to meet their specific interests now become the de facto standard to be imposed on all other companies. I don't think that's reasonable. The third point on rights of way is that policy and tax stability are important. This isn't a 2 to 3 day window as Senator Taylor was trying to pursue in his earlier questions. This has been going on for a number of years. In fact, this came to a head over a year ago in February of 1997 when CANAS, the company building the fiber optic along the pipeline corridor, was in the same box that GCI is in today. They had applied for their permits 8 or 10 months before then, and the state had failed to issue those permits in a timely manner. And when it finally came down to the point that they had to have the permits or lose the project, the state came to them with an offer. Well, why don't you pay us more than what we're entitled to under the regulations, or why don't you voluntarily give us some free capacity in your fiber? go ahead and process your permits. That resulted in a rather contentious meeting that was chaired by the Lieutenant Governor in February of 97, where at the end of the meeting, she noted that the state had done what was seemingly the impossible. They had united the telecommunications industry on a single issue. It's probably the only issue in the history of the state that every single company in the telecom industry agreed on, which was that the state should maintain the historic telecommunications pricing, and it should issue the permits to CNAS immediately. The industry at that meeting understood market value as it's being used in the CNAS permits to mean the market value of the land, and industry's expectations, I think, aligned very closely with what Commissioner Shively told you, that in many cases, the market value of the land will be below the 6 cents a foot rate. $100 an acre may be a very appropriate market value along the pipeline. Unlikely that that's the appraised market value of the land on the bottom of Prince William Sound. So we left that meeting with the administration in February of 96 with a commitment that they'd maintain existing policy. That's what the industry's looking at when it's looking at history. Now this issue comes up again when GCI happens to be in the same box that CNAS was in, where we have a $130 million project, which we've spent more than half on. There's no way to back out at this point, but we don't have our permits yet. Our permits have been in process for 8 months, and all of a sudden we're in a political trap of, well, gosh, maybe now that they're underway with the project, we ought to raise the price of the permits. That's not policy stability. It's a tax stability issue, too, because when the issue of value of use hits the table, you're not talking just entry policy, you're talking tax. A value of use is essentially an excise tax or a royalty. You're saying that the 6 inches of ground that you want for your fiber optic cable is worth more than the 6 inches of ground that you want for the gas line. You're not saying anything more there than that, gosh, here's an opportunity to stick industry for a little more money, and maybe even more still now that we got them in a box since they've already spent $60 million starting this project. That's not the kind of stability that's going to induce the economic investment that the state 2 years ago said it was willing to subsidize to the tune of $50 million. Does any of this really matter? Representative Cott suggested on the House floor that a difference of $1 million a year in what the companies had to pay wouldn't affect their investment decisions. Well, that's right and that's wrong. With respect to the existing cable, you got us in a box. We've spent almost $80 million on the cable on the way to Seattle on a $130 million project. While at a certain point this may result in endless litigation, that cable is going to be constructed at this point because there's no way back to that from that project. Is that reasonable for the industry? Does it send good signals to the industry? I think not. I think when we were clearly encouraged to plan this project under existing structures, under a structure where we expected to pay $97,000 a year for our right-of-way, 350 miles of right-of-way that we want, 300 miles is underwater. And we expected to pay $100,000 a year for that right-of-way, and it's now being suggested that that right-of-way should cost perhaps as much as $800,000 a year. Had we known that in advance, we would have designed a very different route. The route we designed goes from Anchorage to Whittier, and then from Whittier to Valdez, and Valdez on down the inside waters so that it can come in with a leg to Juneau, and then on from there to Seattle. The prior cable that went in, the cable that went through Seward, went through only 30 miles of state right-of-way until it was in international waters and it stopped paying anything. If we'd known that the state was thinking of charging 50 cents a foot, we would have dropped Valdez and Juneau from the construction program, because $30 million extra in cost to run the cable into those two locations, combined with an $800,000 increase in operating cost, would have simply wiped those markets off the economic feasibility scale. Well, we're pregnant now. We're going to go ahead with those markets on this run, but it makes a big difference for what happens next. Within 5 to 6 years, we'll be building a second cable. Not because the first cable will be out of capacity, but because there won't be an adequate capacity to back up the first cable. As we noted with undersea cables, when they cut, you can be out for 2 to 3 weeks at a time. within 5 or 6 years, we'll simply have more traffic on that cable than can possibly be backed up by satellite. And even though we won't make any more money by building a second cable, we'll need to construct, and the state will need to have a second cable so that if one of the two is cut, the communications can run around in the other direction. Our desired route for that second cable is to build from Anchorage to Homer, and then to run from Homer to Seattle with a drop into Ketchikan. We would then build unrepeated cable, which is just cable that doesn't have electronics in it, within Southeast Alaska, from Ketchikan to Petersburg to Wrangell to Sitka and back to Juneau, closing the loop back in Juneau so that all of Southeast Alaska would be part of a looped system. At the 50 cents a foot rate, well, under the existing regulations, that system would cost us $121,000 a year in right-of-ways. Under the proposed 50 cents a foot rate, that system would cost us more than $1 million a year in right-of-ways, and I can assure you that that is already an economically marginal project, and the $1 million a year would clearly sink it. So if the state wants single thread into Juneau, and it's going to get Juneau only because it didn't change the rates in time, well, then it ought to go ahead and go with this market value of use pricing. If the state wants a solid, redundant telecommunications infrastructure, it should go with the policy that the governor is proposing, which is a policy of keeping the rates low to induce investment. What's really going on here? This is just phone wars. And what phone wars is always all about is it's about competition. As usual, GCI is out there wanting more competition, and somebody else is out there wanting less competition. The one who wants less competition in this case is WorldNet, the guys who already have the cable along the railroad and who are saying that they're going to build a cable to Seattle. Well, it's my belief that they don't want to build to Seattle this year, that they don't have any customers for that cable yet, and I don't think they have financing for that cable yet. They insist they do, but I'll be upfront, I don't believe them. And I think what they want to do is they want to stop GCI from building this year. And this whole ruckus has come up because of a squadron of lobbyists that they've hired to run around and raise this issue of market value of use. Are we putting millions of dollars at risk and not getting our value, and in the process delaying the issuance of GCI's permits, or perhaps getting GCI's permits issued in a way that we're reluctant to build? Now, I can't conceive that we're not going to go ahead and build this, and I suspect when we build it, the issue goes away because they've missed their objective. But let's look at what they're doing. They're proposing to increase our undersea costs from $100,000 a year to $800,000 a year. Yet they filed to build on the same undersea route. If we compare what they will pay to the railroad for the first 5 years of their lease from Anchorage to Whittier with what GCI will pay to the state for Anchorage to Whittier through Powerline Pass, the total difference over the first 5 years is $273,000. And for the first 4 years, GCI has paid more than they have because their lease builds up from zero. If we then add in under the current proposal and the renewed proposal what would be paid for the undersea and look at the total five-year lease rate to the state, under the current environment, over 5 years, WorldNet would pay $1.2 million. And GCI would pay $955,000, a difference of $270,000-some-odd. Under the proposal that WorldNet has been pushing, which would raise the undersea rates to 50 cents a foot, they would pay $5.1 million over that five-year period, and GCI would pay $5 million. So they want you to believe that they're interested in raising their costs by $3.9 million over that five-year period to raise our costs by $4 million and to reduce a $273,000 parity issue to a $100,000 parity issue. I don't think that's really what's going on here. I think what's going on here is an effort to stop the issuance of the permits or condition them in a way that GCI doesn't make this year's construction season, thus buying WorldNet what it really wants, which is another year to decide whether to build to Seattle. Thank you.
Just at least as far as my understanding, this is not a phone war that I understand. And I usually have a pretty good idea what's going on in the understandable phone wars.
Maybe you could explain some of the others to me.
No, you've tried to explain them to me. And I don't. But I guess maybe we need to go back to some of this. Let's hear from the other side of the same arguments. And then you stay, they'll stay. And then maybe the commissioner might have a comment too. One simple question. If the governor goes forward with permits and issues his permits with a relatively short-term reopener, that says there's going to be some kind of a hearing process, whatever it is, and come back to the next legislature, that doesn't do you any harm, does it?
It doesn't do the state any harm in the sense that you're going to get the current cable because you got us in a corner that we can't get out of. Is it consistent with the message that this legislature has consistently, has on other fronts, attempted to send to industry, that it's going to invite investment by offering stable tax and investment policies? No, I think it's entirely inconsistent. I think it's very unfair to our company, who planned a project based on one rate and is now being asked to take an open-ended exposure for as much as a 10 times increase in that rate. Will it stop the cable from being constructed? No. Will it give you a chance to have the pleasure of going through this and having another round of phone wars next year? Yes.
Well, I don't think I disagree with your comment. And that's the reason I asked what's the difference in the value of a right-of-way, whether it has a phone cable in it, a power cable in it, a gas line in it, or a fiber optic cable. I think when you add some kind of a profitability market standard in the sense of the product flowing through it, then you might just as well take a percentage of profit and be done with it. And I'm not sure that we've done very well in net profits leasing for oil or in net profits anything that the state has done. I suppose we could instead of doing any of this stuff, we could just go out to bid and say that the right-of-way goes to whatever company will give the state the highest net profit share of their overall profit from the communications occurring.
I think there you run into a problem with the Communications Act, which says that rights of way have to be non-discriminatory. And while it's arguable, we believe there's a very strong argument that non-discriminatory means not only among communications providers, but among utility providers, which means that if we need a 6-inch wide hole in the ground to bury a communications cable, and NSTAR needs a 6-inch wide hole in the ground to bury a gas line through Power Line Pass, that you violate the Federal Telecommunications Act if you charge the telecommunications utility differently than you charge the gas utility. We would happily agree to...
Net profits leasing was a total failure. We had leases that had more than 100% bid. So I'm not advocating what I said, you know, regardless of the communication.
Canass has said, and we would agree, that we would go along with a reopener if that reopener was non-discriminatory across all utilities. If the state wants to give us a lease condition, I don't care if it's a 6-month reopener, if it's conditioned on reopening subject to a policy reevaluation that applies on a non-discriminatory basis to all utilities based on the state asset that they're using and not the value that they're putting that use to, you'll have no disagreement with us. That would be just fine. Our problem is when you say we want to reopen just for fiber optic facilities and we want to explore this value of use pricing, which is an open-ended tax on it. You've got us trapped with a $130 million investment, and obviously even this state isn't going to get the charge high enough that we're going to walk away from the $130 million investment, but that's not an industry-friendly approach.
That's a sunk cost. You won't sink anymore.
You're right. And it's going to be a long time before you see another fiber optic case. So,
Senator Taylor.
Ron, I got to tell you this. I take great offense at these shots about you've got us trapped, that you've got us in a box. There's one person in this room put you in any box. None. You know who put you in the box? You need to go up one more floor.
I need to
talk to those boys because they're the ones that were holding you hostage, according to your testimony, in 1997 when you still couldn't get your permits. They dinked around with it for 8 months. Hadn't told you what they were going to charge you. Then you finally had to go to the mat with them and knock somebody up alongside the head and say, this whole thing's going to die, and we're going public with it if you don't get off your butt and come up with a price. That's what happened. Now, for you to sit there and blame this legislature for wanting to find out what went on behind closed doors when you slapped them alongside the head, believe me, that's our job. Personally, I want to see the flat, I want to see something that's flat, equal, open for every single person out there that wants to build a cable. And I don't care where they come from. I don't care if they're alien. I don't care if they land on a spacecraft, come from Australia, or live in downtown Anchorage. They ought to get treated the same. And the public ought to know you're going to get treated the same. The public ought to know if you're getting held hostage and somebody wants to charge you 50 cents plus to go across the pristine little state park and 6 cents to go across someplace else, and we ought to have it explained to us. That's why I held the hearing. I still haven't had it explained to me. You haven't explained it to me. You've just said, here's what I got, here's what I relied on, and for God's sakes, don't screw it up on me. I'm in the middle of a big project. I'm sympathetic to that. One other item, and I want you to respond to these things. One other item. Who in this legislature has told you 50 cents a foot for every square inch of this land is what this legislature wants? Because this kid doesn't. I want something that says fair market, and a fair market may be fair market use of land, or it may be fair market land value, and it's a policy we ought to establish. Personally, I like value. If the darn land is worth 50 bucks an acre, charge 50 bucks an acre. If it's only worth 10 cents an acre, charge 10 cents, but charge it to everybody. I got memos here flying around within these departments within 2 or 3 days of the time the letter issues. Half the department's headed over the hill this direction. Another part's going that way. Park system wants you to pay 50 cents. This guy wants 6 cents. And I can't make sense out of it, Ron, from my perspective. I'm supposed to be down here looking out for the two things. Are we going to get a decent system built in this state, and is that important to us? And should we help in that process? Because I always have before for 14 years. What is it going to cost people? And is that something that does have value to the state? And should we get a fair price? Should we subsidize it? What should we do? And instead, I just get letters from the third floor that says, if you don't do something, I'm going to do what I damn well please. Because that's what he said now to us twice. And I find that very offensive. So I'm sorry if my comments have bothered you, but I've never changed my position as concerns this industry and its development in this state. I was there when you guys did the big opening in Anchorage on your cable. Appreciate it very much that you're building it. Was there asking people to get into Southeast Alaska as quick as you can. I want to help that happen. I don't think we're getting much help here from this administration because we have no guidance from them. They obviously had something they made a decision on, Ron, some policy. Now, where did that policy come from? How did that policy occur? What is it based on? What were the decisions made on the third floor? Who was there? And did they care about more about parks than they cared about mudlands? Did they care more about satisfying some greenies maybe in Anchorage than they cared about taking care of the people of the state? I don't know that yet. But I'll tell you, I don't want your project held up. I want it to go forward. I want to see an interim permit granted. I'd like to see 2 or 3 years. Let us all get together, find out what the policy is, and go from there. But I'm not holding you up. I don't know if anybody else wants to hold you up for any 50 cents a foot.
Well, I will apologize for using you when I should have stated the state, because the beef is with the state of Alaska. There are people in the legislature who have made efforts to hold us up. What happened on the House side is an absolute travesty. They didn't know what they were doing. They passed something that generates more confusion than it solves. It uses terms that are undefined, that they don't know what they mean, and it creates a higher probability that the permits won't be granted in a timely manner. You are right. There have been disagreements within the bureaucracy as to what the appropriate amount to charge was. However, at this point, this is a case where the governor is trying to do the right thing. The policy that the governor ultimately decided on was to keep the rates low to induce investment. It was consistent with the TIC policy of 2 years ago that says we need those types of investments, and we're not going to raise the rates in the face of those investments. I won't get into the politics of why the governor is advising the legislature and what his intentions are and what's going on there. You folks can understand that much better than I can, but clearly what's at play here is politics, because one competitor is making a lot of noise about what the rates are and what they should be. And there's certainly been press coverage of this issue. With respect to the rate through the park, the short and simple answer on 50 cents through the park is GCI caved. We needed the permit, and it appeared to us that if we tried to hold out for 6 cents a foot, which we felt was the appropriate rate, that we could still be holding out for 6 cents a foot next year this time. We need the permits. We need to build the system. We're willing to pay 50 cents through the park if that's what it takes, because it's not a very big piece. We want to get our system up and operating. And if the what we don't want is we don't want to buy into an open-ended permit that invites people to come back and tax just the fiber optic industry. If you ask us to buy into an open-ended permit that assures us that all utilities will be treated in a non-discriminatory fashion, I'll sign that piece of paper right here today. If it's a permit that invites just a revaluation of fiber optic pricing, that's a very hard one to buy into, because once we've made that investment and the only people that you have on the hook to raise the cost to are the fiber optic people, that's not a very big constituency to assure that we don't lose the full value of that investment.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, let's go to Lowell Humphrey.
Thank you, Senator Helford, for the opportunity to present our position here today and members of the committee. My name is Lowell Humphrey. I'm the general manager of Knauss Telecom Incorporated. Our owners are made up of three Native corporations, Otna Incorporated, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, and Chugach Regional Corporation. Our fourth owner is our contractor, MFS Network Technologies. We have 3 years ago made our decisions on the financing of our project and pursued the Alyeska services contract, long-term contract. We, in order to win that job, had to bid a 15-year hard dollar price for services, which we did at that time, based upon the state's historical approach to right-of-way costs, and obviously our cost of money and all the associated risks with the project. As we have started out on this project, as was mentioned earlier, the first thing that happened to us was DOT was in a delay game, and it just kept getting delayed, and we were out of time. And their suggestion was that what we should do is go ahead and allow them to use some of our fibers that we were going to spend our capital for, so that the state could put their own network in on our fibers in direct competition to us.
And obviously that was not the basis that we could agree to. We went to the mat and in February of 1997, and at the conclusion of that, it was pretty clear, I thought, to all of us that we were going to stick with our historical practice. And in the case of DOT, they did stick with what their regulation said, and we got promptly got our permits for DOT lands. Probably half of our right-of-way is DOT. We have 840 miles of fiber in the ground today. We will be starting traffic on that the 1st of September. And the total DNR right-of-way mileage is about 260 miles. We were, again, had to get started on our project. We agreed, thinking that the state would follow the traditional approach and their historical approach on appraisal. So we proceeded ahead, accepting the fact that the appraisal would happen at the conclusion of the project. We have some private lands that we're crossing over. We have a lot of federal land that we're crossing over. The federal BLM lands require an appraisal. We did not know our exact route at the beginning of the project, so we had to wait till we developed our final route before we could go into the appraisal process. We are at the point of beginning the appraisal process, since we now have our route in the ground and are ready to go forward. It would be a pretty devastating financial hit to us to go from the historical, just on the DNR lands, where we expected historically that we would be probably under $20,000 a year for the DNR rights away, and now at the 50-cent level, we're looking at an order of magnitude $800,000, in the high $700,000 for rights away. That's a tremendous hit in our operating costs. It also means that some of the other projects that we're looking at to expand our infrastructure that basically we put in first for Alyeska, we put in far more than Alyeska needs, and it's our intention to serve the other communities where we have our existing system in place. Now, if we have to spend real expensive rights away to get to these other smaller communities, we're going to be very reluctant to spend it, and we'll probably will not be able to bank the job. So we, you know, where Mr. Duncan was saying they're halfway through a project, we got our fiber in the ground. And we're at a point here where we expected that we would be consistent. Now, the 6 cents a square, 6 cents a running foot, $100 an acre, gets our costs up to about $50,000 a year, $60,000 a year. And we're saying that's an acceptable increase. It's kind of like, well, you know, it wasn't what we expected, but can we live with that? We could probably live with that. But don't take me to $800,000. So as I look at this, you know, picking on a single industry to say we got you, we ought to get you harder, it becomes further unclear, because here's what's going on, you know, nationally. Electric companies, pipeline companies, as they lay their pipelines or their new electric wiring, they put in a fiber cable. And why do they do that? Because they need communications to control their facility. As what we're building for Alyeska, they're going to be controlling the pipeline on the system we're building. But you know, if you were building a smaller pipeline, you'll just lay a fiber right alongside that same right-of-way. But are they going to put in just enough for themselves? Of course not. Because digging the trench is the expensive part in planting it. The fiber itself is relatively inexpensive to go from one pair to 20 pairs. So suddenly, the electric company is now in the fiber business. What are they going to pay for right-of-way, gentlemen and ladies? Suddenly, the pipeline company, the gas company, they're in the fiber business. Now, how does that play out? So, I mean, again, we believe, and we have said in writing, that if you want to charge them all consistent, look at them all. We're up for that. But charge everybody the same. Now, as to the railroad right-of-way is a very special case. The railroad apparently has the authority and the power to negotiate an exclusive use contract. The other state agencies do not have that right.
Doesn't the railroad have three cables on it now?
I do not know how many cables.
The map that we've got shows part of the railroad with three cables. We got this from DNR, but it looks like between at least Anchorage and Portage, you got GCI, Pacific Telecom.
That's the one coming up from World Seward. Net. That's the one coming up from Seward.
Yeah.
What I'm talking about is the Anchorage to Fairbanks route.
Yeah.
And when you carve out the 25-foot sweet spot where it's easy land, you've saved yourself a considerable amount of construction costs. And whatever that's worth, and you negotiate that, and you also negotiate the right to block out the other your competitors, that's worth a premium.
Well,
and so you pay that premium.
There's some argument as to whether the railroad had the authority to give the contract.
I'm not going there. I ain't no place I'm going.
We said specifically how long they can lease land for, and they lease with a reopener that's probably not within their legal authority.
Mm-hmm. I'm not there to open that can of worms. But it's what I'm saying is, you know, just to compare the two, it's, you know, to a non-exclusive right of way where we're out there in our own infrastructure, it is just a wash. So I guess the way I would like to conclude this is I believe that the current statement by the administration that we would use a historical basis, $100 an acre, 5 years, and take the intervening 5 years to look at this policy, this is something I can accept. It's something we believe we can live with in representing my company.
Would you have any objection to that 5 years being 2 or 3 years?
Well, I'm kind of the mindset of our previous position, which we stated in writing, which says if you're going to make everybody the same, then
I agree with everybody being the same. I just wonder whether you go out 5 years and don't get any action until the fourth year.
Right.
Or whether you go out and you say you're going to have somebody go out with a committee and an effort and come back with a proposal.
Well,
that includes all state agencies and all state lands.
It includes all state agencies and all utilities and all people that desire rights away, and everybody's even handed. I'm game for it. I'd sign up for a year. It's not.
Senator Taylor.
Yeah. Throughout the documents that I was referring to, Lowell, and you used the word repeatedly in your presentation, you said we were anticipating an appraisal process.
Yes.
And when you got these permits and interim permits and stuff, what did you assume the word appraisal process meant?
Well, they have done. It wasn't like they've never done an appraisal. It was traditionally the way it was done. An appraisal was done, and whatever the value of the land was, it came out. Now, we looked at the land, we looked at the traditional history, and we anticipated that some of that land might come in at more than $100 an acre, but we thought a lot of it would come in under $100 an acre. And I think Commissioner Shively said in his earlier statements that some of that land is only worth $10 an acre. So from that point of view, we'd made a judgment that we thought that our expectation was that our right-of-way costs just for the DNR lands would be order of magnitude $20,000. And with the $100 an acre leveled out, now we're looking at around $50,000.
But if you go 50 cents...
I don't think anybody can contemplate that. Maybe right. Somebody in the house is though. My only concern was when you used the word appraisal, and it was used here, up until apparently February 25, the lady who's the director of the Division of Land, she thought she was talking about a market appraisal. Now, whether that was a market for value of land or market for use, I don't know. But it seems to me that to do an appraisal, you go through a process.
That's right.
You look at the land. It's all rock and mountainside going up there. You got a blast and just get to it. It's not worth much for right away. It's going to be very expensive to put it in.
Right.
Right alongside the road or something. There's an old road out there. Probably pretty easy to put in. It's remote. Nobody's going to get near it. But worth a little bit more. That's, to me, is an appraisal process.
Yep.
But when you sit down with somebody in a room and somebody says, the whole thing's worth X amount per foot, period. Mm-hmm. What appraisal process do you think Department of Natural Resources used? I mean, did we just rely on Mr. Shively picking a number out of the air? Or do you have some answer to that? I don't know what process was used here.
I obviously don't have an answer for that at this point. All I'm saying is I looked at it as a businessman. It got me in an acceptable range. It didn't kill my project. It didn't kill the future of the project. And my shareholders didn't get burned too badly. So I accepted it.
So basically, we started off everybody thinking for all this time we're going to have an appraisal process, and it'll be something based on something reasonable, and we can all work within that. But when you couldn't get your permits and you finally come down to the wire,
what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Yeah, you end up having to buy them off on their part, so they're happy there, and then you have to turn around and just take a number they pick out of the air with no justification whatsoever. Just there it is. Do you like it? And you say, well, it ain't what we want, but we can live with it. You may very well be better off to have this legislation grant you an interim permit for 2 years, get a committee out here with some objectivity to sit back and say, wait a minute, what's this stuff really worth? And do what they were saying they were going to do with you all the way along. Do some kind of appraisal. And the appraisal should come up with a number. It seems to me that you'd be better off in that fashion than being held hostage by the administration of whatever they want to come up with.
If we can try and keep moving on. Senator Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Humphrey, you said that the BLM, federal BLM, requires an appraisal and that you're in the process negotiating, are you? They come back with anything as this point? Or have you any idea as to what that appraisal might be?
It's my understanding, Senator, that that there is a hard set of rules for the interior lands. And that we had planned that when our project was complete, and right now we're into that completion phase, that we would hire an appraiser and say, appraise the U.S. Department of Interior lands, or BLM, I guess it's BLM, the agency lands. At the same time, we would have the rules from the state, and we would appraise those as well. So we'd hire an appraiser to do the whole job, not hire one appraiser for the federal lands, another for the state lands, and another one for private lands. There's some private lands involved as well.
Do we have any idea for the federal lands that are appraised what that figure is?
The Commissioner of Natural Resources is shaking his head. That would be the first question. The second question would be, is it an appraisal based on value of land or an appraisal based on value of use?
And Mr. Chairman, I heard Mr. Humphrey say that they're hiring the appraiser, that it isn't a BLM necessarily appraisal or the federal government doing the appraisal, that they're doing the appraisal.
There's an approval mechanism. Sure. It's only a question of who pays for it. And I mean, we can't hire an appraiser that the federal government says, it has to be acceptable to them, and they have professional standards that they have to adhere to. So that's pretty typically done on any state land.
I'd be interested to see what some of those, the federal guidelines are, or if any of that has been done.
Thank you. If we can, we'll go to the teleconference to John Burns.
In fact, he thought that was going to happen, Georgie. He thought we were going to come up with some standards.
Yes, this is John Burns. Thank you, Chairman Halpert, for the opportunity to testify today. I am the Vice President for Alaska Projects at WCI, WorldNet Communications, Inc. And through our investment in Alaska FiberStar, we participated in the construction of a high-capacity fiber optic cable from Anchorage to Fairbanks last summer. And an affiliated company is currently constructing a high-capacity fiber optic project between Alaska and Oregon. I'd like immediately to go and correct any concerns that Mr. Duncan had about whether we are constructing that project. The fiber is in the water between Whittier and Valdez and Anchorage and Whittier, so we are going ahead. Altogether, we have spent or committed more than $150 million for Alaska telecommunications projects. And what I would like to do today is discuss fairness, but primarily to correct the numerous misconceptions that have become established in this discussion. I'd like to begin with some of those misconceptions. First of all, the administration has said that 6 cents a linear foot is a historic price. And yet, I think through the testimony we've heard today, we could not find today a fiber optic project along a substantial corridor that has ever been priced at 6 cents a linear foot. The documents that I find that have the greatest history apply to the MFS CANAS project going back to 1996, when in the entry permit, the notion of an appraisal was first raised and committed to through the balance of the project. In terms of historical perspective, there have been, in the meantime, other projects. First of all, I would point to the Alaskan with a permit with a railroad in 1994, which was established by appraisal. Alaskan chose to get out of that permit in the following year. Subsequently, Alaska FiberStar's permit, WCI's permit, GCI's permit with the railroad all have utilized the railroad's appraisal process. A second misconception. The administration says that a legislative act is needed to pursue anything other than the 6 cent a foot proposal. This is not true. As discussed by the commissioner earlier, he does have the means to use an appraisal if so he fits. It was purely a decision between the commissioner and the governor. The third misconception, that Alaska FiberStar is using an exclusive right-of-way. The right-of-way language applying to the Alaska FiberStar project is specific. Within 25 feet, other utilities can be placed. The only exception is fiber optics. And as has been discussed earlier, the railroad indeed has a 200-foot right-of-way. Therefore, theoretically, as many as 8 corridors could be available. Speaking to the physical realities of going up and down the track, as one of the members of this committee noted recently, there are already 3 between Anchorage and Portage. Multiple corridors are possible, and if any company would like one like the AFS, I recommend they talk to the railroad. The fourth misconception, that the pricing of 6 cents a foot needs to be made a decision now because pricing is holding up the development of projects. This is also untrue. We just need to review the testimony that's already been given today. As Mr. Humphrey said, the AFS has finished his project. We have finished our project. GCI is well underway under its construction. All of these decisions were made months and months ago. They did not come up March 11th, 1998. So I'd like to go back to fairness. There should be 2 points made. First, when WorldNet Communications came to Alaska and decided to invest in the Alaska FiberStar project, it believes that Alaska offered opportunities to provide competitive telecommunication services under a set of rules that apply to all competitors. In fact, that is what the Telecommunications Act of 1996 requires. Fairness is the key to competition, but it appears that this spring, beginning in March, fairness will not be offered in Alaska. The fact is that the AFS permit from the railroad was established by an independent third-party appraisal. And we'll pay the railroad approximately $1.8 million a year for 35 years as a minimum. And there is an opportunity for the railroad to earn much, much more. On the other hand, the MFS CNAS permit, issued already by the Department of Natural Resources, is only waiting for its appraisal. They agreed to have that value set by appraisal. The question of fairness is why, in March 1998, the administration intervened, setting aside valuation by appraisal, and unilaterally stating that all permits, including the MFS CNAS permit, would be at 6 cents a foot. I want to correct another misconception that was stated earlier by Mr. Duncan right at this point. WCI would never recommend a single figure and has not advocated a policy of 50 cents a foot. We advocate a policy of appraisal. Appraisal is really the only true fair way to get a value for the state that is also fair to the company that requests the right of way. But before we finish with the question of fairness, there is the issue of what is fair between companies such as AFS and the state. When AFS wanted to utilize a public asset to make our commercial project viable, we agreed to pay a market-based fee because it was fair to the railroad and the state. Because any corridor between two commercially significant locations is a valuable asset. And if it happens to be owned by the state, then the state should receive the appropriate compensation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Just so I can understand this, the Alaska Railroad rates on Fiberstar, on GCI, and on the old Alascom permit were all set by appraisal?
No, the railroad for AFS, GCI, and WorldNet Communication has a third permit. We're all set by appraisal. The old Alascom one was before the railroad had instituted its appraisal process.
What was that rate, just for curiosity?
There is a permit rate plus provision to the railroad of a spare fiber and copper wire. I don't have the details memorized, sir.
And that one expired anyway. It's not of any significance.
No, I believe it's still being utilized today. Lauren Herman is here across the table, and she could intervene.
Okay. Sir, this is Lauren Herman. I think the Alaska Railroad permit that you think are suggesting expired is the one between Anchorage and Fairbanks. We originally had applied for a permit on railroad right away between Anchorage and Fairbanks, and shortly after the acquisition of Alascom by AT&T, we exercised our option not to pursue that lease. There is an existing lease between Anchorage and Seward, where the North Pacific Cable Spur comes from Seward to Anchorage, and that is in existence today. That is the lease that was negotiated prior to there being a fair market value policy at the Alaska Railroad. Or, I'm sorry, an appraisal policy at the Alaska Railroad, I believe.
Yes, and I thank Lori for that. Clarified and believing that you meant between Anchorage and Fairbanks, yes, Alascom executed a permit with the railroad on the appraisal basis.
Okay, the appraisal basis that we're talking about, is that an appraisal based on value of land or an appraisal based on value of use?
It is an appraisal based upon the value of land assembled into a corridor. The notion is that value to someone desiring a corridor is based upon the two points or multiple points they choose to connect.
Further questions? We are going to have to break, I believe, to go to session. What I'm going to do is continue this to tomorrow at 3:30, recognizing that there's a conflict with state affairs, and we will try to work through that. State affairs may be a short meeting, but we will come back to this tomorrow. And thank you very much, and I'm sorry we didn't get all the way through this. We have to go back for a floor session. We're already 15 minutes late for what they had that.